find the defendants incredibly guilty.
Find this ultimate chicken sandwich on brioche bun to be guilty of being delicious.
Right.
What section of the Constitution has been breached?
There is no one section. It's just the vibe of the thing.
Objection, Your Honor.
What?
He's leading the witness.
Same.
You break, we're both lawyers.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
And welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 255. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. And Andrew, are we on Mueller Report Watch?
We are, and we will be talking about that in the C segment.
I expect Brian to have come up with some really intense music right there and put it in. Mueller Report Watch, hour number 27. Still no report. And then that's the segment. That's the segment. But I keep seeing these little headlines that are like, the report could be coming. We see it in the distance with our telescopes.
Yeah, I have seen those reports, and I have thoughts on them. So,
well, we're going to get to that. Also, I mean, I think we need to give a shout out to your son nailing this debate competition this weekend, right? At a certain point, Andrew, I was talking to Andrew, and he's like, hey, my son's 483-0 in the debate competition. I'm like, well, surely that means he won like 12 contests and has done like a multinational tour of debating. He's like, no, that's just the morning rounds. And then the afternoon, there's another 800 debates. That, talk about a marathon. That's incredible.
Yeah, they do six preliminary rounds at Harvard, and my son won all six of those. He was the second overall seed. He won nine in a row before finally losing. I was super proud, and I just couldn't be happier. He's doing fantastically well.
That's awesome. Opening argument shout out. Congratulations. And
he listens to the show, so
right.
I'll get to hear that. And speaking of listening to the show, I want to direct our listeners. I will include a link in the show notes, but I was on episode 87 of the So Here's My Story podcast with two friends of mine, Jody Hume and Elliot Wagenheim. It's a business stories podcast. This is really neat. It's a really neat show that they do, and I tell my story of being an accidental lawyer. So if you like that sort of thing, I think you'll like listening to the show.
All right, good stuff. Well, with that said, I think we can do some yodeling today.
Yeah, this will be a yodel-heavy day, is for sure.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
Nobody, so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse? I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
So Roger Stone continues to make really good decisions with his life. He ought to go into the life coach business, you know? Like, I feel like he could dole out advice to people. Yeah, people keep saying, now I will say this. This kept getting reported as Roger Stone puts target on judge. And like, to be, to play the literal devil's advocate, because this guy,
right.
there's like a bull's, or, you know, a target thingy to the left of the judge's face in the picture. Now, I'm not saying it's like fine. I'm just saying a little bit different. I imagine based on hearing the reporting in the news that it was going to be a giant, like, you know, the circle with the crosshairs, like right on her, you know, nose or something. But it's even kind of weirder, because I don't even know it's got to be intentional, but it's weird. It's like these people always do this, you know, the signaling in a way that kind of has some amount of deniability. But anyway, wow, what's going to happen here? How? What could be the punishment? What are the implications of this?
So, yeah, I think I'm really glad you explained the distinction on that, because I think that the sources that are describing the Instagram post, I keep wanting to say Snapchat again. So
we, Snapchat have another... is for private witness tampering, as we've learned on this show. Right. I think Instagram is for just public right. evidence against yourself. We'll say
you're 100% correct in that A, it's weird what Roger Stone did, which was put up a picture of Judge Amy Berman Jackson and then put the little reticule, the little crosshairs kind of up and to the left. Yeah. And so the media reports that make you think, because I thought the exact same thing when I went to look at it, like, oh yeah, it's going to be superimposed over her face. It will be, you know, an unmistakable, you know, signal out there of, hey, if you're part of the Trump loving lunatic fringe, go out and murder this judge.
Just butting in real quick. You know, possibly the largest terrorist attack, you know, since 9/11 was stopped yesterday. Potentially the guy who was going to target Democrats and MSNBC hosts and a number of other people who had just a stockpile of weapons, was inspired by Anders Breivik. Could have been absolute catastrophe. So it's in that environment, by the way, that this crosshairs thing is happening.
Well, and look, I use the example of Pizzagate pretty often, but yeah. A guy showed up at Comet Ping Pong in downtown Washington, D.C. with an assault weapon, you know, demanding to see the private basement in which Hillary Clinton, you know, dismembers children, to be informed that the restaurant does not have a basement. These people are, the threat here is not remote in my mm-hmm. view. So but I think it is super important. And ultimately, of course, Roger Stone's hearing is taking place as we are recording. So we'll get to see if a result comes out by the time we go to press. If it does, you know, we'll make a note of it. If not, you'll have to listen to Tuesday's episode or possibly even a week from today. Here's what's at stake. Judge Jackson. So first, folks have asked about this. Roger Stone immediately filed a notice of apology. I have uploaded that and you will be able to read it in the show notes. That's the strangest legal pleading I've ever seen. I have never had to file an official notice of apology to a judge on behalf of one of my clients before. And, you know, I have some clients for whom it's not implausible to think they might need a notice of apology at some point. Well, really, just one client. We know who that is. But so Stone immediately pulled the picture off of Instagram, filed a notice of apology, which is not a thing, but, you know, so be it. But the question now is whether Judge Jackson is going to hold that Stone violated the terms of the partial gag order that she imposed in this case. And if so, what those sanctions will be. So let's talk about that specifically. The gag order that was issued, I'm going to link this in the show notes as well, says that the parties are, and this is the relevant portion, it is hereby ordered that counsel for the parties and the witnesses must refrain from making statements to the media or in public settings that pose a substantial likelihood of material prejudice to this case. And the other part of the gag order had to do with statements on the courthouse steps, which obviously is not relevant here. And then in a weird aspect in which maybe we could do a Judge Jackson was right segment. There's this piece of advice contained in the order. And again, this is not a typical thing, but I think it goes to show you that that Judge Jackson is sort of at the end of her rope in dealing with somebody like Roger Stone. She says, this order should not be interpreted as modifying or superseding the condition of the defendant's release that absolutely prohibits him from communicating with any witness in the case, either directly or indirectly, nor does this order permit the defendant to intimidate or threaten any witness or engage or attempt to engage in conduct in violation of 18 U.S.C. 1512, which will be the second argument that is raised in this hearing. I'll get to that statute in a minute. And then there's this piece of advice. Finally, while it is not up to the court to advise the defendant as to whether a succession of public statements would be in his best interest at this time, it notes that one factor that will be considered in the evaluation of any future request for relief based on pretrial publicity will be the extent to which the publicity was engendered by the defendant himself. So, you know, this is a no-nonsense judge who knows that Roger Stone's MO is to do his best to taint the jury pool and then demand a change of venue. Judge Jackson was is the judge who is overseeing the Paul Manafort trial, the D.C. Paul Manafort trial, right? And so she's seen this game plan, and so she put those limitations in place. That 18 U.S.C. 1512 statute that I mentioned, that is a statute that prohibits whoever uses physical force or the threat of physical force against any person with intent to either prevent the testimony of any person in an official proceeding or to cause or induce any person to withhold testimony or withhold a record, document, or other object from an official proceeding, or otherwise evade legal process, be absent from a legal proceeding. This is the witness tampering statute. It's not a clear fit when you have maybe arguably threatened to kill a judge or, you know, sort of tried to rile up your troglodyte supporters to kill a judge. And if you were to ask me what I think is most likely, I think the most likely outcome for Stone is that he's going to get a sharper, more clearly defined gag order. And I think that when he moves for a change of venue, citing the provision that I just read to you, Judge Jackson is going to say, no, any problem you have with venue is a problem of your own making. but I have to say, like, I don't think judges like the idea that a defendant before them in their courtroom is implying that they ought to be shot. Yeah. So I know I sure wouldn't if it were me. So, you know, I am interested. It's why I wanted to put this on our radar, because this is an area, right? The conditions of Stone's release, whether he violated the gag order, what additional sanctions to put on him. This is an area in which the trial court judge has wide discretion. And Roger Stone was released on promise of bail, right? I mean, we talked about this, you know, in the prior episode, but he has not even placed any money with the court right now, and there are potential outcomes that include altering the conditions of his release and imposing additional hardships on him. So it'll be interesting. Again, I don't want us to overplay this. I really appreciated your introduction, because, you know, we don't want to be saying that, you know, there was a direct call to action here, but there was definitely weird behavior.
Yeah, I mean, it's still bad. I didn't mean to be defending, right. And I just want to make sure people didn't get the wrong idea, because if you've only listened to it. And by the way, I just remembered the reason this was on Instagram is because he was banned from Twitter.
Right.
I forgot about that for some other expletive-laden rant.
Yeah, look, like, Roger Stone is a master in the art of drawing attention to Roger Stone. It is worth pointing out, and so I want to point it out, that the Stone case, right, is in large measure, the connection here is that Roger Stone obstructed congressional investigations into the hack of the DNC emails and their publication by WikiLeaks. And the pleadings specifically say that his criminal conduct includes tampering with a witness, quote, in coordination with the efforts of a congressional committee to assess whether any U.S. person or campaign coordinated in or had advanced knowledge of the releases of stolen documents. So again, as the goalposts get moving, I mean, you know, we had the really great conversation with AG on our last episode. This is a direct connection between the Trump campaign and efforts by Russia to coordinate an attack on our democracy by stealing the 2016 election. So, you know, the oft repeated, always incorrect assertions by those on the right that, yeah, these are just process crimes, or this is all stuff from, you know, tax fraud from 2008. Roger Stone is a direct link from the Trump campaign to WikiLeaks. So, and again, let's be clear, right, that hasn't been adjudicated yet, but yeah, that's the subject matter of the Stone indictment. So, you know, we are winding our way through the sort of the morass of facts to a situation that absolutely could potentially connect the Trump campaign to efforts by those with ties to and by Russian intelligence assets to disrupt our elections.
Couldn't happen to a nicer guy. So, all right. Well, that's it for this particular little bit of yodeling.
A national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court, just like the band. They sued us in the Ninth Circuit, and we lost, and then we lost in the appellate division, and then we went to the Supreme Court, and we won.
But now we've got to talk about something that I don't think is entirely yodel related, but unless Andrew's going to tell us, it will end up being. Let's talk about Trump declaring an emergency and then subsequently saying, I didn't need to do that, and then golfing for a week, as you do after emergencies happen.
Correct description of what's happening here. I will give, in the interest of diffusing tension and allowing people to, you know, cut to the chase here, because we're gonna go in depth on a lot of the relevant and operative cases. This is not gonna be a good segment. So, what did Trump
not gonna
do?
Be a
good,
what do you mean? Like, it's not
this
the
is,
outcome.
This is yeah, the outcome. The outcome of this, I think, is very, very likely. That Trump is going to be able to raid.
Okay. Here, let me do it in Trump manner. Oh, so he's going to be able to declare an emergency, and then it's going to go to the courts, and then he's going to lose those plays to the courts. And then, did you hear that insane speech that he gave? Or that was the weirdest thing I've ever. It's like his brain short circuited, and he went into a song, but the song was two notes.
I don't know who told him that, right? Like, I think that the fact that he was able to recite that is essentially exactly correct, right? Like,
yeah.
And so it's a little bit terrifying, right? That it lends some support to the thesis that Rudy Giuliani is, you know, aware
of
what
he's doing.
I
think the one thing he has, the one thing he has experienced in for being president is doing something insane. And then having courts be like, dude, no. And then there's going to be some battling, and he's used to it by now. He's like, this is the job of being president, is doing something I'm not supposed to do. Most of the time getting away with it, but sometimes getting sued and it having the Ninth Circuit say no.
Yeah. And look, that's what's going to happen. So what did the president do? He declared a national emergency subject to 50 U.S.C. Section 1621 to, quote, address the border security and humanitarian crisis that is threatening the United States. As you pointed out,
humanitarian crisis that is threatening the United States.
Yeah.
Holy moly. What is that supposed to mean? Because, like, if you just said, hey, Andrew, there's a, or, you know, if I said, hey, Andrew, there's a humanitarian crisis somewhere, you'd picture what, like, starving people or, you know, disease?
Yeah, maybe? I would picture, like, the war in Yemen, right?
Yeah, like
that's,
what?
That's a humanitarian
how is
crisis
it threatening
where 22
us?
Million people are being starved to death by
it's
the
like, in his
Saudi
mind,
army.
There is a humanitarian crisis, as in people are, you know, hungry, needy, dying and stuff in South America. And it's going to hurt us because they're icky and they're going to, like, get on us. Like, they're going to, they have germs and they're going to get over here. Is that, like, that's what I imagine.
Yeah, no, it is the first, you are right to point out that the use of humanitarian crisis here is not, it's a humanitarian crisis and therefore, you know, we need to coordinate our efforts to help these people.
Yeah, like a humanitarian crisis.
It's a humanitarian crisis and
again?
We have to keep them out. Yeah.
Yeah, a humanitarian crisis that is threatening the United States is like, you know, Hurricane Katrina or something. Not, you know, we're... It's, I don't see how we can be threatened by other people. If anything, we just need to help them. We don't. We're not threatened by a humanitarian crisis somewhere else.
Yeah, and as you pointed out in the press conference announcing that this declaration of a state of national emergency, not only did President Trump say Congress has, quote, provided this administration so much money, we don't know what to do with it. And then admitted that in answer to a question that, well, I'll just read Trump's words because you can't improve upon perfection. Maybe I should let you read them in your Trump voice, but I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I didn't need to do this, but I'd rather do it much faster.
And then when he went into his song, we're going to have to do a deep dive on, he ripped off Stairway when he did it, actually.
Yeah, right. No. So, look, the fundamental underlying question is, can the president declare a national state of emergency when there obviously isn't an emergency and the president himself has said there isn't an emergency?
I've listened to this show long enough to know that the answer is yes, because no one will do anything about it.
Well, look, people are doing
people
things
try.
About it. We talk about what states of emergencies mean in episode 243, and we actually went into a bunch of the specific sections that that Donald Trump invoked in this declaration as a hypothetical. And so, in fact, 10 U.S.C. 2808, I talked about an episode 243, and here we are in episode 255. That's exactly one of the provisions that that Trump has cited. There are also a lot of lawsuits that are challenging this declaration. I'm going to link a couple in the show notes that we don't have time to talk about, and so I will tell you just very, very briefly. There's a lawsuit filed by various landowners that was filed in the district court for the District of Columbia. That will be over the fact that building the wall on people's property is going to physically take part of their property. That can be justified under eminent domain. That's on our whiteboard list. But it is not clear on a practical level, you know, how sort of jury rigging this through the various provisions that are authorized by Congress under the National Emergencies Act, whether that's going to comply with those constitutional requirements. So I'm going to include that lawsuit in the show notes. There was also a lawsuit filed on behalf of the Sierra Club by ACLU lawyers that essentially alleges that environmental impact studies were not done, required environmental impact studies. Look, when you have an $8 billion construction project, right, that is necessarily going to destroy some ecosystems. And before you do that, you are required under various applicable laws to conduct, they are EIS, environmental impact studies reports, clearly were not done in this case. And the Sierra Club lawsuit.
I just feel like this wall, we've been talking about a wall for a long time. There hasn't been they haven't done this ahead of time or in the Bush years, there wasn't like an analysis of what a wall would do to the environment, you know, like none of that ever happened?
So not sufficient to comply with the EIS, okay, right? Like you, because there is sort of a general notion of, you know, we're going to do it here, but you have to actually know, okay, we're going to drive a post here and right, that post is going to be in the middle of, you know, federally protected wetlands, for example, can be a really, really small area. In my old house, the little stream that ran through my backyard was a federally protected wetland. Like you could literally jump over it, right? So it was, you know, a three foot wide designation. And so, you know, whether the wall was built on that particular spot or whether it got moved a couple of feet, right, would determine whether it complies. And look, and that's the whole point. I know, you know, we have some conservative and some libertarian listeners. That's the whole point of doing the EIS on a giant construction project, right? Which is, if sticking the post in location A would potentially destroy a unique ecosystem, but sticking it 3 feet to the north would not, then you want to know that so that you can not destroy, right? All things being equal, you'd rather not destroy the ecosystem if you don't have to. And, you know, and again, in an, I get the, you know, kind of libertarian railing against, you know, paperwork and the like, an $8 billion project, right? This is not something where the costs are prohibitive or the delay is really extensive, but it hasn't been done. So that's a little bit of a deep dive into the lawsuit we're not going to talk about, which it actually overlaps with a lawsuit that I do want to talk about, which was filed in district court in California. So as Donald Trump predicted, this will go to the Ninth Circuit. It was brought by 16 states: California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Michigan, Minnesota, Nevada, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, Oregon, and Virginia. It alleges four counts. Count four is the environmental impact. And again, we just talked about that. That's, you know, all I want to say about the environmental impact part. The other three counts in the lawsuit are variations of an argument on separation of powers, right? And essentially what the argument says is that Donald Trump went to Congress to get authorization and funding to build a wall. Congress said no, and he's going to build it anyway. And the argument is that is circumventing the powers, the separation of powers that require Your Congress Honor, to spend.
I rest my case.
And so the threshold question really for all of these is going to be, right, I can tell you right now what the Trump administration is going to argue in response. So let me quote from the first claim of for relief: violation of constitutional separation of powers. Article 1, Section 1 of the U.S. Constitution enumerates that all legislative power shall be vested in the Congress. Article 1, Section 7, Clause 2, known as the Presentment Clause, requires that bills passed by the House of Representatives and the Senate be presented to the president for signature. The president then has the choice to sign or veto the bill, right? I mean, this obviously reads like a freshman, you know, high school civics class, right? defendants have violated the separation of powers by taking executive action to fund a border wall for which Congress has refused to appropriate funding. The 2019 Appropriations Act is an explicit denial of the president's requested funding for a border wall. The second claim, violation of the Appropriations Clause. It's the same argument, right? But presenting, you know, from a different section of the Constitution. The third claim is a term we have used on the show before, ultra-virus. And again, that just means acting beyond your authorized ability to act. What Trump's lawyers are going to say is, no, we haven't exceeded our authority at all. Congress has already delegated in statutes the ability for a president to declare a national state of emergency and has delegated in advance certain powers that spring forward once that declaration has been enacted, right?
Right. And, however, counterpoint, uh-huh. Your Honor, this would essentially make Congress meaningless, like in terms of the power of the purse. If the yes, they gave the right, you know, Congress legislated the right to for the president to declare an emergency. But if the idea is, therefore, the president has the right to declare an emergency over anything and move any money to anything he wants, then it isn't it just a free for all? Like then Congress can't tell the president what to do.
Well, in terms of money. And that is right. So there are essentially two types of questions here. The first is this declaration of a state of emergency a valid declaration? Hmm. Let's table that question for a minute.
Okay.
If it is a valid declaration, then the question is, what specific powers can the president invoke as a result of declaring a national emergency? And it is not the power to move any amount of money anywhere from anything. There are three specific sections that the executive order invokes. And let's take a look at all three of those, right? Okay. So the first is that the declaration reallocates $601 million from the Treasury Forfeiture Fund. I had no idea what the Treasury Forfeiture Fund is, or rather I should say was, because this loots 100% of the Treasury Forfeiture Fund. The Treasury Forfeiture Fund is the repository for all of the stuff that is civilly and criminally forfeited. Yeah. I will link in the show notes. Their budget for 2018 is still estimated. It was estimated to be $410 million in terms of amount of money coming in 2018. And the operating costs, these are called mandatory items. And so those are, right, the expenses of storing assets that have been forfeited. Valid liens and mortgages, right? Like, so if somebody else has an interest in a property, you know, piece of property that is swept up in civil asset forfeiture, you know, you've got to figure out how to give that back to the person who owns it. Investigative expenses, information, inventory systems, victim restoration, right? Because sometimes the government steals stuff, in civil asset forfeiture that is not an instrumentality of a crime, and they have to give it back, right? All of that stuff. And then also the costs of recompensing local police agencies when you have joint law enforcement operations. There are 25 full-time governmental employees. So you put all of that together, the operating costs of the Treasury Forfeiture Fund are $580 million. This, as far as I can tell, takes all of that money away from the TFF and uses it to build the wall. If this lawsuit is going to succeed on the ultra-virus claim, this is where I think the lawsuit has the best chance of success, because there is absolutely no connection between what the TFF is supposed to do and building Trump's wall. It is just being used as a slush fund. And, you know, now might not be.
Well, what you were saying earlier then is it's not as though, you know, as I said, you can't take money from anything for anything. There's specific places you can take money from, or at least some, I don't know, reasonable transfer of money. But this you're thinking this is not a reasonable use of this power.
Yeah. This law is 31 USC 9703. There are no lawsuits. there's no case law. There's no direction for any of these specific sections that we're about to talk about that says, you know, here's what the government can and can't do with the money. But in the other two areas, at least, there is at least a kind of paper thin veneer of, hey, you know, this is kind of related to X. Here, there really isn't any connection whatsoever. And you know, now might not be a bad time to reference that the Supreme Court just ruled in Timms versus Indiana that the provisions of the Eighth Amendment are incorporated out to the states. And that was, you may recall, we talked about that in episode 234 involving the hypothetical of the state of Indiana seizing a $1 million Bugatti for going 5 miles an hour over the speed limit. Civil asset, criminal asset forfeiture is a contentious issue in the courts already, and it's an issue that that brings together scholars both left and right. And so, raiding the civil asset forfeiture fund is, I think, the area where this lawsuit has the greatest chance of success. It's also the smallest amount of money, right? It's six-tenths of $1 billion, right? $601 million.
Chump change.
Yeah. Yeah. If you have $601 million, head on over to patreon.com/law. So that's the first section. The second section comes from $2.5 billion under DOD funds transferred for support for counter drug activities pursuant to 10 USC section 284. This is an interesting provision, and it's something that I haven't seen anybody report on. Section 284 is not contingent on a declaration of national emergency. Right. So in other words, even if the national emergency is determined to be not an emergency by the courts, right, that threshold question that we're sort of punting to the end of this, this provision says the Secretary of Defense, quote, may provide support for counter drug activities or activities to counter transnational organized crime. Such support may include, quote, construction of roads and fences and installation of lighting to block drug smuggling corridors across international boundaries of the United States. So, again, you see how that there is, I think, at least a veneer of, well, it says you could build a fence as well as a road and as well as lights and all that. And this is kind of like building a fence, even though it is, you know, a big, beautiful wall. And so I think the determination of whether 284 funds can be used in this way, it will be interesting. I searched through Lexis. There are zero cases interpreting 10 USC 284. There's no way to know what construction of roads and fences means under that statute. And so it will be interesting to see how the case adjudicates that. And then the third section is $3.6 billion reallocated from DOD military construction projects under the President's Declaration of a National Emergency, 10 USC, Section 2808. That was the area we talked about in episode 243. And what it says is that that in a national emergency, the Secretary of Defense may undertake, quote, military construction projects, end of quote, that are necessary to support such use of the armed forces. So,
yeah, that's not this, but okay.
Yeah, well, no, that's right.
That's like build a little bridge over a river because you need it for supplies, for troops, for fighting a war, you know, like that kind of thing, right?
That is absolutely what the term is meant to convey. Military construction is defined in 2801A as any construction, development, conversion, or extension of any kind carried with respect to a military installation, whether to satisfy temporary or permanent requirements, or any acquisition of land or construction of a defense access road. That's it. So building a wall is absolutely not a military construction project as that term is defined in U.S. law. So this is another area in my view where you'll be able to present some pretty strong arguments that those funds are not appropriately used in the construction of the wall.
Hey, listeners, you know, so many people have their own businesses or starting their own podcasts, YouTube channels. whatever it might be. And one of the best ways to make connections and to look professional and to really feel professional as well is by having a nice business card. You never know when opportunity is going to strike, and having a business card that shows how professional you are in your pocket, ready to hand out, is the first step to making something happen. Your next big opportunity is coming right now, and all it takes to feel like you're ready to own the now is $10. That's a low price to have the confidence that you're always ready to make an impression or get seen in a new way. A custom card with the colors, fonts, and designs and images you choose means you can look and feel like a big deal, whether you're a startup or a business with a century of history. And it doesn't have to be hard. With Vistaprint, you can create a truly professional, unique card in minutes. You upload your design or start with one of their professionally designed options. Vistaprint offers simple tools and a wide range of templates to choose from. You pick the paper stock, the style, and the quantity that's right for you. Choose your delivery speed, order, and receive your cards in as few as 3 days. And your satisfaction is 100% guaranteed, or they will make it right either by reprinting your order or offering a refund. Vistaprint wants you to be able to own the now in any situation, which is why our listeners will get 500 high-quality custom business cards starting at $9.99. Use code OA at Vistaprint.com. That's code OA at Vistaprint.com. One last time, OA at Vistaprint.com. So, you know, I just realized something, and let me know if I'm anywhere on the right track with this, because I'm worried. Because I've, you know, it turns out, I think maybe we've already talked about this in the last emergency episode. I can't remember, but there's a way that Congress can, you know, there's the provision that says Congress can say it's not a valid emergency. But of course, you would need to get a bunch of Republicans on board to do that. Is that going to be used in these lawsuits? Like, if they don't do that, if Congress either doesn't go that route, it seems like Democrats in the House will try, or if there's not enough Republicans to pass that, will that be used as evidence in a court case of like, well, Congress could have said this is not valid and they have not done that. So therefore, it's kind of assumed that this is that Congress approves of it.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's a really, really perceptive question. As this episode goes to air tomorrow, Friday, the Democratic House is introducing a resolution to say that this is a valid declaration of an emergency in precisely the mechanism that we talked about in episode 243. It will be interesting to see whether it will obviously pass the House. It will be interesting to see whether it passes the Senate. Right. You only need 4 Republicans to be slightly less than insane for it to pass the Senate. But as we discussed in 243, the president can just veto that. And it obviously.
But we still want to make him do that because it's ridiculous.
Yep. No, absolutely right. Absolutely correct. And the court will be able to take judicial notice of what happens there. So you are 100% correct. That also, I think, really presages the end of this conversation, which is logically the first part. How much discretion does the president have to declare a state of emergency when he said this isn't an emergency? And the answer to that really looks back. So again, I told you none of these specific provisions have ever been litigated. The Emergency Powers Act itself has been litigated a handful of times. And again, what Trump's lawyers are going to do is they're going to quote from a couple of different cases. The primary one is a case called Dames and Moore versus Reagan. And that's Don Regan, not Ronald Reagan, in which the Supreme Court held that matters intimately related to foreign policy and national security are rarely proper subjects for judicial intervention. And federal courts have historically declined to review, quote, the essentially political questions surrounding the declaration or continuance of a national emergency, end of quote. The Regan case was involved the end of the Iranian hostage crisis. And what happened there was when Iran seized American hostages at the American embassy in Tehran, President Jimmy Carter responded by invoking the National Emergency Act. That was a national emergency, declared a national emergency and blocked the transfer out of any Iranian assets, any Iranian assets that were held in U.S. banks. Right when Iran seized Americans at the American embassy in Tehran and held them hostage for 2 years, those in response, President Carter embargoed Iran and put a freeze on all Iranian assets that were being held in U.S. banks. Right. So Iranians could not get their money out of the United States. When Reagan was elected, 100% in response to the national crisis over the American hostages in Iran, when those hostages were returned to the United States, the condition, one of the conditions of that return was releasing those assets. And as you might imagine, there was litigation regarding the authority of President Reagan to unilaterally order the release of the assets, particularly given that the national emergency was, quote, over at that point, right? Like the hostages were back. They were in the United States. That case held, yeah, look, it is a non-justiciable political question as to whether the president had grounds for declaring the national emergency and or continuing the national emergency. Similarly, there was a case, this is just a district court case, but the language is similar. It's a case called Beacon Products Corp versus Reagan. It involved the declaration of a national emergency with respect to Nicaragua, and essentially prohibited U.S. companies from trading with Nicaragua. And the court said, to address the claim that Nicaragua does not pose an unusual and extraordinary threat to the United States would be an imprudent exercise of judicial review. In effect, such review would require the court to assess the wisdom of the president's judgment concerning the nature and extent of that threat, a matter not susceptible to judicially manageable standards. How, for example, is the court to determine whether Nicaragua poses more than an ordinary or usual threat? How is a court to resolve disputed issues of fact concerning the situation in Nicaragua? The court lacks the resources and expertise to address these questions. Consequently, we find that whether Nicaragua poses a sufficient threat to trigger the president's powers is a non-justiciable political question. I could go through this, but the important takeaway is that the headline grabbing comment, as you mentioned at the start of the segment, was Donald Trump saying, yeah, you know, this is not really an emergency, right? I could have done it some other way, but I preferred to do this in a way that was faster. That is kind of the sexy fact, but it would not surprise me to see that play no role in the actual resolution of the opinion. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me for the district court in California to say, while we are troubled by President Trump's invocation of a national emergency, while simultaneously disclaiming any emergency, this opinion is not, and does not stand for the proposition that that the president's authority to declare a national emergency is anything other than plenary. I expect to see that language in the district court's opinion. That being said, I certainly could see the district court and perhaps the Ninth Circuit ruling that at least two-thirds of the avenues, right, the 2808 defense projects and the TFF funds, that there is no rational relationship between the use of those funds, between the powers that were declared to the president, that were devolved to the president by the Congress under those particular provisions, and what this president wants to do, right? Like that is determining that the president is acting ultra virus, is acting beyond his authority, that is the kind of thing that courts decide, right? And so I think that that there is some potential for success on those, on two-thirds of the source of the funding, about 60% of the overall of the six plus billion that that Trump wants to loot from other you know, actually delegated projects. I think that we have some possibility of success on that. The 284, you know, it again, this doesn't have anything to do with, like, we know that building a wall with Mexico doesn't have anything to do with drug interdiction, but I think the court is likely to defer to the president's determination on, you know, whether building a fence as authorized by 10 USC 284 is necessary for our counterterrorism efforts. So I did warn you at the beginning, I thought this was not going to be a great segment, and that's why.
Oh, man. I am looking at your unrealistic timeline here, Andrew. You've got a lot of bullet points still to go, and we're running out of time.
Yep. Well, it's...
In typical Andrew Torres fashion, so we better move on.
Move on.
All right, so if you're predicting, then you predict this unless we get a miracle and a veto-proof majority in the Senate, decides to put, you know, which I would think we had 8 years of Obama and how much the executive has too much power, you know, so I would think we could take all that the Republicans complained about for 8 entire years and, you know, get them to be consistent on that. But no, alas, probably not.
Yeah. Again, I think we're likely to get a trial court ruling and affirmance by the Ninth Circuit that that holds that blocks part of the executive order, but I don't think that they're going to block it in its entirety. You know, we'll see. Hey, we do an Andrew was wrong segment, so maybe I'll be wrong on that, but don't think I am.
All right, well, back to yep. Yodeling.
And may I help you, Doctor?
Oh, it's me, Dr. Rosenfeinitz. I'm just here to check Dr. out Hill? Danwick's file. Dr. Rosen, I'm here to get some records.
Okay, we are back yodeling. We had to take a break from yodeling, go down, you know, get supplies and provisions and come back. And we are now back on Yodel Mountain. Wow, lots of bullet points here. Tell us about your buddy Rod Rosenstein, going to be replaced.
Yeah, Rod Rosenstein is going to step down. We heard the initial reports on that when Bill Barr would be confirmed after sort of ensuring an orderly transition and handoff of the Mueller investigation, because Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, would no longer be running it because the current attorney general is not recused and ethically walled off from dealing with the Mueller investigation, that in Rod we trust would resign. That's probably going to happen within a month. And we know that Donald Trump's pick to replace Rod Rosenstein, thus necessitating that delightful intro that Brian put together for us, is Jeffrey Rosen. Rosen replacing Rosenstein. Like Bill Barr, Jeffrey Rosen is a longstanding Republican operative, and again, sort of by the standards of this administration, is, you know, look, he's no Matthew Whitaker, right? He is somebody who has solid academic and professional credentials. He was a partner at Kirkland & Ellis. He's been general counsel in several executive agencies. He's somebody, you know, look, like, are we likely to agree with what Rosen does? Probably not. But as I've said from the beginning, right, I doubt Rod Rosenstein and I have ever voted the same way on anything as a matter of politics. Rod Rosenstein is a doctrinaire, lifelong conservative Republican. The fact that he's going to be replaced by another doctrinaire, lifelong conservative Republican, you know, is not not necessarily that the sky is falling. So that's where we stand with respect to that.
Oh, wow. Oh, that was faster than expected. Don't look now. We might make it. Okay. this is very disturbing. I'm glad we left it for a bullet point at the end of the show. Are we sending nuclear secrets to Saudi Arabia, and what in the world, what happened with that? Was it a mind control orb that Trump was touching with all the, that weird meeting two years ago, the orb.
This is really, really disturbing. So this is a February 19th, just 2 days ago, House Oversight Committee report prepared by Congressman Elijah Cummings. And the two, I'm going to link it in the show notes. The two main takeaways are, number one, that U.S. military contractors are set to make billions of dollars on the transfer of nuclear secrets to Saudi Arabia. And number two, that Jared Kushner has been described by our intelligence community, that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, the person who ordered the beheading of Jamal Khashoggi, has said, oh, yeah, Jared Kushner's in my pocket. That's a lot disturbing. So here's what the report says. Whistleblowers have come forward to warn about efforts inside the White House to transfer highly sensitive U.S. nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia in potential violation of the Atomic Energy Act and without review by Congress as required by law. Those efforts may be ongoing to this day. The Trump administration's interactions with Saudi Arabia have been shrouded in secrecy. In 2017, Jared Kushner orchestrated a visit to Saudi Arabia and met on his own with Mohammed bin Salman, who subsequently bragged that Mr. Kushner was, quote, in his pockets, in his pocket. Within the United States, private commercial interests have been pressing aggressively for the transfer of highly sensitive nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia, a potential risk to U.S. national security. These commercial entities stand to reap billions of dollars through contracts associated with constructing and operating nuclear facilities in Saudi Arabia and have been in close and repeated contact with President Trump and his administration to the present day. And then, you know, I could continue, but the important thing here, and this goes back to the question that you asked from the outset, which is, you know, is Rosen coming in replacing Rosenstein? Does that mean there was a report by CNN that says, you know, the Mueller report is almost finished? Does that mean that all of this is over? Right. Like, you know, Donald Trump Jr. hasn't been indicted yet. You know, higher up administration officials haven't been indicted yet.
Yeah. This is like when you get to the end of a season, you're binging on Netflix and you're like, but they haven't done this. That's almost the end. What the heck?
Yeah, and I would say we're halfway through, right? If the Mueller investigation is a procedural crime drama, and it kind of is, we're halfway through, two thirds of the way through. Like, there are more episodes yet to binge, and one of the things, you know, we talked about this.
So you're saying the report isn't the series finale?
Correct. And I don't know. By the way, I mean, there have been a lot of reports in the press over the past year of, oh yeah, no, Mueller is almost done, right? Like, he's going to wrap it up. Mueller extended the grand jury for another 6 months. So, you know, and that has five more months to run, right? So it certainly could be the case that he's about to wrap up. But even if that is the case, right, there are still all of these ongoing operations that have flow out of what Mueller and his team have done, right? So there is the independent operations in the Southern District of New York in connection with Michael Cohen and in connection with the subpoenas delivered to the Trump inaugural committee, which, oh my gosh, you know, maybe we can do a Patreon only special on that. Like, those connections are numerous and terrifying and rife with potential fraud. There is, you know, my buddy Brian Frosch and the Maryland DC emoluments lawsuit, which is in the discovery phase, right? So, you know, there are the separate proceedings that have been brought by New York's attorney general, right? The one that led to the dissolution, the voluntary dissolution of the Trump Foundation for being a scam, right? And there are now, you know, robust. I mean, there's the ongoing Senate intelligence investigation. We've talked about that, but there's now robust oversight by the House of Representatives. This is not the efforts to unravel what this administration is doing will continue, even if the Mueller report comes out in a couple of weeks, and even if it is, what we talked about on sort of the more, minimalist end in terms of not drawing the explicit connections, not having the smocking gun, so to speak. But I'm not convinced that it is coming out in a week. I'm not convinced that it isn't. But even if it does, this will not shut it down.
And I know it just feels so pointless sometimes to say this, but we had a president who they called a secret Muslim who was going to go, the Iran deal. Oh, what a bust of a deal. Meanwhile, Trump backed out of that deal. Iran is still following it. And now Trump's giving nuclear secrets to Saudi Arabia and Republicans don't care.
It is certainly I don't. It's why I read from the report. And again, I have to believe that there are patriotic Republicans that care about nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, right? Like I didn't read this section, but there is an explicit compilation of, Mohammed bin Salman saying, yeah, we intend to convert, whatever nuclear technology we get into becoming a nuclear power. It's that is massively destabilizing. And as you point out, right, like my saying, I don't want to continue to see nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, right? That's not a like crazy lefty hippie kind of thing, right? Like that's the core of American foreign policy since 1945.
25 years.
You know?
Oh, more than that. Yeah, okay.
Nuclear proliferation is dangerous. Certainly, nuclear proliferation to authoritarian regimes with no internal controls and those that are run by, religious heads of state. This is terrifying stuff. But I think I've terrified you enough, so.
Am I too depressed to be terrified? I don't know. All right. Manafort, quick. We got to get through these last few bullet points.
We'll bang them out. So in episode 253, we discussed Judge Jackson's findings that Manafort lied. The sentencing report came in for the Eastern District of Virginia. So relying upon those findings, but Judge Jackson obviously is in the DC case. I predicted that that sentencing was going to get Manafort at least a 40 and maybe up to 43 on the U.S. sentencing guidelines. The report was a 38, right? This is still 20 to 28 years in prison, 19 and a half to 28 years in prison. It is very, very conservative and very, very defensible. And that's what Manafort is going to get. He's going to get a sentence level of 38 in the Eastern District of Virginia. He will still be awaiting sentencing, which will come down the second week of March in the D.C. trial. And remember, the fact that he's violated his plea deal means that he can be not only subject to a superseding indictment, but he can be retried on the 10 counts in the Eastern District of Virginia for which the jury hung the first time. Again, ostensibly because Rick Gates was such a terrible witness. The prosecutors could recharge and retry Manafort on those 10 counts. They don't even need to get a superseding indictment on that. So more is coming for our ostrich jacket wearing friend, Paul Manafort.
All right. And Cohen going to be testifying. This will be a big event. Right?
This absolutely will be a big event. February 27th. which is a Wednesday. So we get to talk about this a week from now.
We may be able to do an early
well,
recording.
Well, sneak preview of Tuesday's episode. The 27th is also the day for oral arguments in the Bladensburg Cross case before the Supreme Court. And I will be at the Supreme Court along with our friends from the American Humanist Association, our friends from the FFRF. I'm speaking at their rally on the Supreme Court steps. So I don't think we'll be able to record on that Wednesday, but we will have timely information 1 week from today when Michael Cohen testifies at an open hearing before the House of Representatives next Wednesday. That is going to be amazing. and the fact that it's open, right, is exactly what it sounds like. So it will be really, really interesting to see exactly to what so far our most reliable flipper is going to testify.
All right. Well, I'm just finding out all this at the same time as you are, listeners. So sorry, no Wednesday show, because Andrew's going to be speaking on the courthouse steps.
It's going to be fun. We'll talk about that on next Tuesday's episode.
Well, I think that does it for our bullet points. Congratulations. That was not too bad of a lightning round, especially by Andrew standards. It was actually an incredible lightning round. So we'll have to move on to our favorite segment, which is thanking our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats over patreon.com/law. And these fine folks, of course, support the show at the $5 level or above, and they will be enjoying Lot Awful Movies very soon in the Q&A and all that good stuff. And we start with Bijou and Bangles, custom and handcrafted jewelry. Stephen Baltikai Sandoval, choice early follow unlock spider decrease.
I got nothing.
Okay. Cut maps. We are going to build a Death Star and make Alderaan pay for it. Still waiting for the sled dogs Andrew promised last week. I'll try you. So I guess it's cut off. Rodimus Prime 2020. He's made of sterner. Stormy McKendrick. My watch is set to executive time. Happy birthday, Amar. Oh, that's nice.
Happy birthday, Amar.
Hey, Alexa, play Winds of Change by Scorpions.
That is amazing.
And you'll have to let us know if that patron got any of you. John Bilderback, AFSPDaniel.com. Support the overnight walk to #StopSuicide. Metacarpal Uniforms is an anagram of Paul Manafort crimes. Republicans, not safe to vote for ever again. Monica, CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. The Registry Matters podcast. CClampQuest.org, CClampQuest.org, CClampQuest.org. Came for the yodels, stayed for the intelligent legal analysis. Well, you got a lot of yodels today. Burbank Makerspace, unintelligible real property question. Oh, yeah, that was last week. Hearsay, theirsay, everywhere say. DataHack.com, business automation, making the menial automatic. Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew is a close second. A banana socialist democracy. Blank Boxman, congratulations to Roz on the name change. Kurt Robinson, Karen, I forgot to put beans on the grocery list. Can you get me some tonight? Kiowa Valley Exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. Let me be totally clear. I like being totally clear. Cosmo, insert Springsteen reference here, but... I think it's usually blues, right? Schrodinger's Andrew is right and wrong at the same time. Michael Cohen is a no-talent ass clown. Sam Buck, the Getting Off podcast. Milo Meadsong, the Halfling Bard and SIU3L. Chris Rowden, it's an itsy bitsy teeny weeny. Karma Fleet declares Jita Freighters illegal. I don't know what that is. Sorry. Jita Freighters. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Mike the Intactivist. Mueller on the Orient Express. that features, what's his name? Kenneth Branagh with an insane mustache. That's that latest one. Polychuck, is there any such thing as common law impeachment? Rob Schreck, James, Daylin Lee Samus Grix. When I'm wrong, my wife grants me admitting privileges. And finally, for me, The Castle is the greatest legal movie of all time. Ain't it, Darl?
Huh? So, well, finally you for you, but not finally for all of us. I also have to thank Anonymous, Brian Upshaw's Last Chance for Profit Prison, Take My Money, and yes, we will. Buttercup's Legal Services thinks Trump's presidency is the national emergency, 831-CAT-LAW-1. Hopefully they got that number fixed. Some days, even my lucky rocket ship underpants don't help. Yeah, tell me about it. At Women for Conrad Michaels, Blank Box Woman, Advocatus Felis Catus. Oh, yeah, sure. Jerome Corsi hired Larry Klayman to sue Roger Stone. Oh, yeah, and this is on, Thomas can vouch for this. This is on our whiteboard. I promise you we will get to that lawsuit. We just, you know, had a few pressing concerns.
Yeah, that's bullet point 758.
AG for AG. Oh, yeah. Boy, would she not make a fantastic attorney general? WordOrigins.org, your site for legal terms for 13th century Saxony. Liberal Gun Club, a pro Second Amendment voice for left of center gun owners. Zabby, Derek, can the Saints sue the NFL for tortious pass interference? That's just outstanding.
That's amazing.
The official flag football team of opening arguments. This is a real thing.
Wait a minute.
Thomas, we are going to be...
I want to play the hell out of flag football. I will play that. Where is this?
I will send you the information, but we are going to have an official flag football team sponsored in our honor.
If this was anywhere near me, I would play every week or more.
Well, just Oklahoma? Does that...
Not even close.
This millennial was born when we wanted walls torn down, right? Hence the directive for the scorpions. Saul, Gam live in Denver on my birthday. Yeah, it's also Noah's birthday, so you're going to enjoy that. Enrage Moping Nuts is an anagram of opening arguments. Big Easy Blasphemy, a string of unpronounceable characters. Illegally parked time machine pursued for civil forfeiture. Brandon Smith, Impeach the Clown Horn is an anagram for Thomas Smith. Okay, not really. Aaron Rabbi is my favorite philosopher. Aristotle is a close second. That's great. An anagram of Huckabee Sanders is Scuba's Naked Here. Rhonda is wearing her amicus briefs. Malika Chandler, Abacus Flinch, CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org. Soggy Pants, Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Sam Danow, Greg Sullivan, SCOTUS, would you absolutely have to execute someone overnight? Oh, I feel bad about laughing about that, but this pledge is definitely not payment for divulging state secrets. Oh, well. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Matthew Vernon, Aaron Grady, happy birthday to Heather from same Heather. Oh, well, happy birthday, Heather. Ian and Allie. Sakashite Fukasumi is a Lizzie lad, not a Bernie bro. Saint Muller, patron saint of yodelers. Eli Bosnick, Mitchell. If Picard isn't the best captain, why is he the one coming back? Yeah, good question. The Reflex is an only child. He's waiting in the park. Classic. Conrad Michaels Jr. wannabe, and our all-time great, our number one, he who will never be overthrown, Conrad Michaels. Thanks to all of you.
All right, and time for a real TTTBE, not a prank one, but I deserved the karma of last week, I feel like. So let's go to question 115.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, Thomas. Yes, yeah, serious, real question here. In a personal injury case, the plaintiff sued a retail store for the injuries she sustained from a fall in the store. The plaintiff alleged that the store had negligently allowed its entryway to become slippery from snow tracked in from the sidewalk. Before the lawsuit was filed, when the plaintiff first threatened to sue, the store's manager said, quote, I know that there was slush on that marble entryway, but I think your 4-inch high heels were the real cause of your fall. So let's agree that we'll pay your medical bills and you release us from any claims you might have. End of quote. The plaintiff refused the offer. At trial, the plaintiff seeks to testify as to the manager's statement that there was slush on that marble entryway. Is the statement about the slush in the entryway admissible? A. No, because it is a statement made in the course of compromise negotiations. B, no, because the manager denied that the slippery condition was the cause of the plaintiff's fall. C, Yes, as a statement by an agent in about a matter within the scope of his authority, or D, yes, because the rule excluding offers of compromise does not protect statements of fact made during compromise negotiations.
We've talked about this. My initial reaction was, wait a minute, I remember we've talked about this. You can't use the idea because, you know, the court system wants to encourage settlement, I think, and you don't want to, you know, use a statement in the course of having a settlement agreement to as evidence later. So I swear that I'm guessing that's going to be called the rule excluding offers of compromise. However, I think this is trying to trick me because, okay, when the stores manager said, okay, before the lawsuit was filed, when the plaintiff first threatened to sue, the store manager said, it just says said, we don't know what context that is. Okay. Said, I know there's slush on the, but I think your 4-inch heels were the real cause of your fall. So let's agree that we'll pay your medical bills. Plaintiff refused the offer. Oh man. This is tough. So anyway, going through the answers, I really think this exception could be it, but I wonder if it's trying to trick me because it's not, it wasn't quite in the middle of negotiations. We're not totally sure based on the question. Like, was this a, you know, as part of an offer for a settlement. I don't know. I don't know what technically the statement has to be excluded. So I'm leaning toward, let's see. So we got A, no, because it was a statement made in the course of compromise negotiations. That's a strong one because that's what I think is happening. B, no, because the manager denied that the slippery condition was the cause of the plaintiff's fall. Now, I don't think that's right. It seems like a one I can just eliminate. However, there's a part of me that thinks if this is actually a hearsay question in disguise, you know, that kind of thing, where it's like, because it's not against interest in that case, you know, like then you wouldn't be able to do. I'm going to hope that's not where this question is going. And I'm going to say not B. C, yes, as a statement by an agent about a matter within the scope of his authority. I mean, that would be, that might be an okay one if the compromise thingy isn't, you know, if that's not excluded. Or D, yes, because the rule excluding offers of compromise does not protect statements of fact made during compromise negotiations. So is it D? I don't know. I feel like D shouldn't be right. You know, because I feel like in the court system, in the justice system, we want people to be able to sit down and talk and be like, all right, you know, you, let's be real. I don't think you did this, but blah, blah, blah. And maybe settle. And then I'm pretty sure what we discussed some years, months or years back about this is that you wouldn't want to use that. You wouldn't want that to be admissible. So I'm thinking not D, but then is it A or is it C? Like is C would be the answer if it has nothing to do with offers of compromise because it's, you know, maybe it's not officially in a letter of or something like that. You know, maybe there's some way that it has to be presented to actually fall under the offer of compromise. But let's assume, I'm just going to, just for fun, I'm going to assume this is counted as a statement made in the course of compromise negotiations because I think it probably should be. And I'm going to go ahead and say A. I'm going to keep it simple. A, no, because it's a statement made in the course of compromise negotiations.
All right. And if you'd like to play along with Thomas on TTTB, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include your guess. Include the reasons, therefore, the hashtag TTTBE. And we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. And I was a little frantic there because we're so over time. I was trying to like rush it, but hopefully people got the point. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks most of all to our supporters. And keep an eye on that patron feed for all the goodies coming at you toward the end of the month here. And we'll see everybody else on Tuesday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at OpenArgs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.